Welcome to the Dispatch Podcast. I'm Steve Hayes, joined today by Chuck Todd, moderator of Meet the Press and political director at NBC News, my former colleague from years ago at the Hotline and current colleague at NBC News. Chuck and I talk about primary day today, another Tuesday. What will we learn? What races are important? What should we be looking for? The general primary season, what have we seen so far? We talk a bit about the January 6th committee, what we expect to learn there, what their challenges in making their case, presenting their facts. And then we end with some really overindulgent talk about the Green Bay Packers. Hope you stick around. Chuck, welcome back to the Dispatch Podcast.
Good to be here, my friend.
I want to start today with the primaries. There are some today. Today's a Tuesday, so it's a primary day. There are primaries across the country. There's not sort of the big splashy primary that we've seen in places like Ohio and Georgia, Pennsylvania, but there are some interesting House races and House primaries, things that could give us sort of further understanding of what we're looking at, both in this primary season and also as we look forward to November. Is there anything that you're paying particular attention to today?
You know, I in theory, this is supposed to be the Super Tuesday of primary days, right? You have, seven states on, in theory, more people voting today than any other day of the year other than November. Now, that's mostly because of the presence of California and New Jersey, two fairly large states that are both voting today. But you're right, there isn't like this marquee about the only statewide that's of some interest. And it's because I pay a lot more attention to Iowa politics than most people. But it's the Dem statewide primary for the Senate race against Grassley. And that's, you know, if that's your headliner, you don't have a lead. Right.
So right, you
know,
right.
We get it, you know. But if I'm looking at anything today, there is sort of a, and what we did in First Read, our newsletter, to try to give this a national feel, there's this incredible poll question in Pew that came out in the latest Pew survey. The survey itself is about a month old, but they just released the question. And it was this, that two-thirds of both Democrats and Republicans believe that all or most candidates who run for office do so to benefit their own personal interests, not the community's interests. And overall, it was something like only one in four voters believe the average person who runs for office is doing it for the greater good. That is an alarming stat, right? That is forget democracy dying in darkness. This is democracy dying in sort of self-interest. And if you look at today's elections, right, you have an attempt at creating more voter accountability, but it's all deflection of blame. So you have the recall in San Francisco. You've got some incumbent House members who are trying to, hey, my challenger is more of a career politician than I am. You know, trying to create, you have, look at Young Kim is doing. My favorite ad of the cycle that proves this point is a Young Kim ad. The attack is politician John Smith. I can't remember the primary foe is, so my apologies. But it demonizes the word politician. Like, you know, and so I'm curious to see if voters are responding to that. I think the pathetic turnout that we're going to see is only another reminder that I think if you don't think the candidates care about you, then why should you care about them and why should you vote? So, you know, in that sense, that's how I'm today feels like Apathy Tuesday a little bit. And the question is it Apathy Tuesday? Is it Anger Tuesday? Is this apathy and anger rolled up into one, you know? And yeah, maybe I'm pulling a muscle to try to nationalize it too much. I'm not going to deny that. But there's definitely tea leaves that are being produced here that are worth reading. How's that?
What do you have? Is there, and I don't mean to put you on the spot, but let me put you on the spot. Are there historical analogs to that Pew question? I mean, we certainly saw a dip in, you know, more broadly in confidence in government and elected officials after Watergate
'90s. That's the baseline election we looked at to see, just to answer you that question there. The incumbent reelection rate that year was at an all-time low, and it was 85%.
Wow.
You know, the point is that here you have all this anger at people that run for office and all this anger at career politicians. And if you look at, I watch probably anywhere from 20 to 30 TV ads every day right now, because they're just coming in. You know, we have this subscription service that we get a copy of all these ads. And it's a good way of, number one, figuring out how to pronounce candidate names, right?
Right, that's always helpful. Right.
To make sure, I don't know if us old text guys who learned to cover politics in writing, I never get pronouncements right. Pronouncers right. You sit there and like, well, I've called this guy so-and-so. So that's what he's going to be, because that's how I remembered how to write his name. You start to get a sense of like, clearly everybody's looking at the same polling. And the easiest way to create distrust between a voter and a candidate is to make the candidate seem like another typical politician who just enriches themselves and all this stuff. So, you know, and yet we're still going to have a 90 to 95% reelection rate, right? So it doesn't necessarily match that. But hey, it's a big deal if we go from 95% to 93%. And I mean, look at what I just pointed out with Watergate that year. And the thing is that it's probably the only historical analog we have is the period between the Kennedy assassination, basically Bay of Pigs, through Watergate, right? Lie, 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 misdeception, Vietnam, all of that stuff. You could argue, like, if I were to talk about this era, I'd probably begin with the definition of is. Then I'd go to like mission accomplished. If you think about the erosion of that, right, you'd start probably in the late 90s. And you'd go all the way through where we are today, right? You know, Rome wasn't built in a day and Rome wasn't destroyed in a day, right? And I think that's what this feels like. And this is why we all wonder, the generation below us, they haven't seen America work right yet. You and I grew up in a period where, boy, we usually got our S together, you know, when we really had to.
What do you mean by S?
Shit. Sorry. I don't know. What's the rules here at the Dispatch?
We'll allow it. We'll allow
it. Is it allowed? God, I was watching something what I thought was a basic cable program, and man, they go, there are any rules. What are the rules?
I haven't caught up. No, there's a lot.
All I know is that there's certain things, if you and I say it, we probably lose our job. So I'm like really careful.
Right. No, I find myself when I watch TV with the kids reaching for the remote, like the mute button, like, where, how is this? And sometimes in like animated shows on.
Yeah, no. One of my favorite, and it's a reference that I'm going to keep as an Easter egg here, because I don't want to explain the rest of the episode, because it'll really get me in trouble. But I like to watch It's Always Sunny. And there's a Danny DeVito. Musical scene in one episode that is about sort of, what are the rules? And he just starts saying, what are the rules? Just tell me what the rules are of just sort of interacting in a certain area. That's what I feel like sometimes. Just tell me, somebody tell me the rules.
Tell me what
I don't
do.
Know what they are.
Tell me what to do. So I want to go back, dive a little bit into a race in California that I think illustrates everything that we're talking about. And it's the race to unseat David Valadao, who's a Republican, pretty moderate Republican, voted in favor of impeachment. And California has this unique primary system. Top two vote getters get to go to the general election, regardless of the party. And in an effort to help basically boost challengers to Valadao, the incumbent, Democrats' House Majority PAC is running an ad, both digital and I think television as well, that highlights this guy, Chris Matisse. And that is, to your point about pronunciation, it's spelled M-A-T-H-Y-S, but it's pronounced Matisse, which I learned by watching the ad. Right.
You and yes. I would have been Chris Mathis until we
Correct.
Saw the ad. Right.
Correct.
Sorry, Chris.
So what's happening here is you have Democrats telling us every single day that the House majority, Democratic leadership telling us every single day that the Trumpified Republican Party presents a threat to democracy, an existential threat to democracy, and it's more important than anything that those people be thrown out of office, and then literally turning around and funding the campaigns or boosting the campaigns of those Trumpified Republicans so that they can take out somebody who, in their view, if they actually believe anything, voted the right way on impeachment. Isn't this exactly why people are so cynical?
Look, I wish this were the only example. Josh Shapiro, the candidate for governor in Pennsylvania, did this with Doug Mastriano, made sure Trump, you know, I asked, I'm going to give credit to Claire McCaskill on this topic. She was, is one of the few people, she was on my panel and she voiced this conundrum. She said, look, I'd love to run against these Trump candidates. Eric, and she's, of course, obsessed with Missouri. Eric Greitens is probably, you know, a poster child of this, right?
Former senator from Missouri.
She's the former senator from Missouri, right? Greitens being the former governor, and a race that Democrats only have a shot in if he's the nominee because of his past accusations of sexual assault. But she said, you know, they can win in this environment. So you need, you know, and she's somebody who did the same thing in her own race, and it worked. It was good politics. Look,
right,
you know,
with Todd
this
Aiken.
Is one of those things that is always good politics in the moment, and it will bite you in the ass at some point. You know, probably in our era, the most famous example of this was Gray Davis. Gray Davis, in 02, very unpopular governor, did not want to run against the former, fairly popular, moderate Republican mayor of L.A., Dick Reardon. So he ran campaign ads in the Republican primary back when California had separate primaries that boosted a former, the son of a former Nixon official, a guy named Bill Simon. Well, Davis succeeded and he got Simon and he successfully was able to win re-election with the worst job approval rating in the history, I think, of any sitting incumbent governor ever to win. And he was recalled 6 months later. Right. Like it was one of those voters were like, yeah, you're right. We'll take you over that guy. But don't think we're going to let you forget this. And it's happening in Illinois governor right now. The governor of Illinois doesn't. Now, this is a battle of political oligarchs in Illinois. You got one billionaire backing one candidate, the mayor of Aurora. You got another billionaire backing another guy. Then you've got an actual billionaire who's the sitting governor. He's the one spending this money. I think it is all adding up to why we have a finding that says essentially three and four people think most people run for office for themselves. And if you're picking your opponent, it means you care more about who you can beat. And again, it's your self-interest rather than the greater good. Because you're right. You know, I'm sorry. Look at how many Democrats crossed over to make sure Brad Raffensperger didn't end up in a runoff in Georgia. So the voters do care about not Trumpifying the country. You know, this is Democratic elites who are, you know, look, they're playing a game here, but you're playing a risky game.
It's so
with
dangerous.
The democracy.
It's yeah. So dangerous. I mean,
it's
honestly,
very dangerous. Hitler's more beatable. You want to nominate Hitler? You want to get him one step closer? I mean, I know the minute you bring him up, you end an argument, and I'm not trying to Godwin's law this conversation, but what the hell are we doing here, man?
Right. It's like, They have been saying, I mean, look, I think, and I want to talk about the January 6th committee and the hearings coming up this week as well. So this is an appropriate transition. They did this from the beginning on January 6th too. The Democrats' impeachment language was crummy. It was not language that Republicans were likely to sign on to. And I am not excusing Republicans for anything related to January 6th and
one of my big pet peeves these days in politics is somebody not being for something because they don't like the language. I mean, because I hear this excuse all the time. Well, the Democrats, stop it. It doesn't excuse you looking the other way on Trump's behavior.
So I totally agree with that. I totally agree with that. But it doesn't mean that you can't criticize Democrats if they're acting, if they're telling us that the country's on fire, if they think that democracy's at stake, if they're deeply concerned about election integrity, and they're worried about what they've seen from Republicans pretending that the election was stolen for partisan advantage, if Democrats are truly concerned about that, and I am, I mean, I'm not a Democrat, I'm not a Republican, but I am really concerned about it. If they're truly concerned about it, you ought to, and you think, you know, Trump and the Trumpification of the Republican Party and this sort of mainstreaming of political violence that we've seen, I think, flow out of January 6th, you can't play games. And that's what I think Nancy Pelosi did with the language of the impeachment resolution. That is certainly what she did with the formation of the committee, the early formation of the committee. They were back behind.
Yeah, I don't hold that against Pelosi. I hold that against McConnell. He made the decision not to allow a bipartisan
He did. And he did it later.
At the same time. Yes. I'm sorry. And it, right. He created this situation. He helped create the conditions for the situation. We all know the House does not know how to behave rationally. I'm sorry. give me a House leader in either party, and I'll show you a leader who's always going to be a partisan actor first.
Right.
Right. It's the, nature of the House.
Yeah. It's the nature
in fairness. It's the nature of the House.
Sure.
So I take your point on Pelosi, but let's remember McConnell shut down the
sure.
one, but we would have had a you know, and the country would be better off for it.
For sure. She, I will say, and I'm not doing this as a defense of McConnell. I've been pretty critical of McConnell. In fact, I think I got some grief for appearing on your show for being as critical of McConnell as I've been
Mitch McConnell hasn't done an interview with me in basically since the arrival of Donald Trump. You know, he fears any sort of rational, straightforward news interview. He stays in Fox lane. I mean,
well,
you know what he's doing.
Pelosi, at the time that Pelosi, so if you look at the founding, the discussions, the debates over the establishment of this what was to have been a bipartisan committee, there are behind the scenes conversations taking place between senior Democrats, senior Republicans who are in favor of the establishment of this kind of a committee. And in the middle of that, Nancy Pelosi sends out a letter to only Democrats in the House of Representatives saying, this is what the committee is going to look like. And the conversation's ended. Now, Democrats can be forgiven for believing when you have 147 Republicans voting, you know, against or objecting to the election, hey, it's not worth getting in here. But after January 6th, I think it was worth at least taking the chance. I think Nancy Pelosi deserves some grief about that.
And we'll take a quick break to hear from Tax Network USA. Do you owe back taxes? Pandemic relief is now over. Along with hiring thousands of new agents and field officers, the IRS has kicked off 2024 by sending over 5 million pay-up letters to those who have unfiled tax returns or balances owed. Don't waive your rights and speak with them on your own. They are not your friends. Tax Network USA, a trusted tax relief firm, has saved over $1 billion in back taxes for their clients, and they can help you secure the best possible deal. Whether you owe $10,000 or $10 million, they can help you. Whether it's business or personal taxes, even if you have the means to pay or you are on a fixed income, they can help financially resolve your tax burdens once and for all. Call 1-800-245-6000 for a private, free consultation or visit tnusa.com/dispatch.
Moving on to the January 6th committee itself and what we're likely to hear in the coming days. Set aside the question of whether these hearings are going to move public opinion. I think most people are pretty skeptical that they will. What do you expect to hear from the committee in terms of the story that the committee is going to tell, the facts that they're going to lay out?
By the way, I saw somebody tweet, and I can't remember who it was, or I'd give them credit, but something said, if we lose focus on the mauling of first graders after a couple of weeks, the insurrection is probably going to get memory hold too. Whether that's good or, I don't think the person was saying it to defend that aspect, just sort of pointing out an American reality. And we saw it, and we released some polling data yesterday that showed that essentially Trump has successfully clawed his way to a draw, right, on essentially the public perception of what happened on January 6th, and what was it, and what and who's responsible. Look, I it's a pretty, you know, just based on the leaks, which I know they've attempted to be strategic with them, right? And we're not going to say how strategic the leaks have been. We'll be able to answer that question better after we see what they have tomorrow night or on Thursday night. But I expect them to paint a pretty, they have a lot of stuff. They have a lot of text. I think they're going to be able to paint a pretty damning timeline that is going to bring this, you know, essentially who was the ringleader here, right? And it is going to, I think all of the lines, some of them are dotted and some of them are straight, are all going to get to Trump, right? Are all going to turn to him, are all going to put this on him in some form. You know, it feels like it's one of those, you know, if you imagine any TV show where you have police investigators trying to put together a puzzle, right? And they have the whiteboard, you know, think Claire Danes in
Homeland, yeah.
In Homeland, right? You know, the putting up everything and you'll have Trump in the center, right? Or think The Sopranos when they were trying to figure out, the FBI's trying to figure out who are the captains and who are the deputies and who are this. That's what I expect them to do. And I think if they don't paint that picture, then what have they been doing? You know what I mean? Like it's pretty obvious to me. And I think the only unknown question I have in my mind about January 6th is how organized was it before the 6th versus the actions of on the 6th, right? How much were they preparing for a moment that might have been like that, right? Versus the moment that they ended up getting. And I think that to me is hopefully some part of that aspect of the story gets answered via depositions that they showcase on Thursday night.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great question. I expect that one of the things that will come out of these hearings is an answer to that question in exactly that way, which is to say, this was not about a day. This was about an effort, a campaign, a months-long effort, weeks and weeks in the making to stop the peaceful transfer of power.
It fell apart on January 6th.
That's correct.
I think that's what we're going to find out. January 6th, the reason it ended up in a riot is that the whole scheme fell apart.
Everything they'd been trying to do to that point hadn't worked, so they did that.
Yeah, exactly. But that was sort of that was the calamity aspect of the whole plan falling apart, not the culmination of a plan, if that makes sense, right?
Yep. Yep, I think that's right. I mean, if you just stop, and I think it's hard to do this in sort of the churn of day-to-day news and politics, but if you just stop and think about some of the things that we know happened in the weeks leading up to that, the Trump-Raffensperger call, I mean, you have the President of the United States telling a Secretary of State to find votes. Cheating.
I think that's
it's
one. Cheating. Everybody keeps wondering, where's Trump going to get held criminally account? I think he's going to get criminally indicted in Fulton County. I think alone should be enough to get the indictment.
He's on tape cheating.
Yeah.
Again, you know, take this out of the Trump era. If that had happened 15 years ago,
there'd be a trial. There'd be a trial already.
Of course. Yeah. And you have so many other details. I mean, you know, we talked about the Jonathan Martin Alex Burns book that we had them on the podcast. You and I have talked about it a bunch. I think one of the things that comes out of reading that book, it was true of John Carl's book and some others as well, is the extent to which we've forgotten about these things that would have been huge in any other, like the details. You have these Trump campaign workers who, or Trump supporters, we'll call them, who went to pressure these ballot counters in Georgia to try to, in effect, convince them to make false claims that they had cheated. Just one after another, the Oval Office meeting with Sidney Powell and these, it's crazy. And the extent to which we just have forgotten about so many of those details, and they will be thrust back into the public consciousness as a result of these hearings, I think that will help at least tell the story. The problem or the challenge is that in our siloed media world, there's going to be a huge chunk of people, I would argue the people who need to hear this stuff most, are not going to hear it. They're not going to hear it at all. And to the extent that it's discussed, they'll get the kind of, you know, bullshit that Tucker Carlson was selling with his Patriot Purge documentary.
You know, it's interesting to go back to one of my daily habits, which is to watch the conversation that's taking place in television ads, essentially. I don't know who's used more to attack a quote so-called rhino Republican, AOC or Liz Cheney. The demonizing of Liz Cheney as a credible conservative, too conservative. It's one of those things like, look, I mean, I've had my own character assassinated. You've had your character assassinated. She's had her character assassinated. Quite a bit by that Fox machine. And it is, so I don't know if she's credible to conservatives, even though she's certainly credible, I think, to independents still. And she's certainly credible to Democrats and independents. But I, you know, the whole theory of her being on that committee is that, hey, Republicans will trust her. I think non-Trump Republicans do certainly believe that, you know, and she's, but I don't know. I mean, the amount of demonizing of her that has taken place on the political airwaves, that's done real damage to her nationally as a credible fact finder.
So I would make the distinction on the right that you made earlier, and necessarily, I think, on the left. I think that is, she has been effectively demonized and marginalized among the political elites on the right, right? Like Fox News hosts, Kevin McCarthy and his cohort, you know, the most active and partisan Republicans feel that way. I don't think that's, and certainly that trickles down into sort of some rank and file Republican voters. Her standing has been eroded, undoubtedly. But I think there's a chunk of Republicans, and as you say, certainly independents, who look at this, and these are, again, not the people who are paying attention to every twist and turn of daily politics, and say, like, wait a second, you're saying Liz Cheney is somehow a squishy left winger? You know, on what issues have her views changed? It just doesn't make sense if you're not paying attention to every little thing or the fights that she's had with
Kevin McCarthy. You define politics, if you're semi new to the political wars, and Trump brought in new people to the political wars, then conservative and liberal is defined by pro-Trump and anti-Trump, right? There is a whole group of voters out there that the definition of conservative is for Trump, and the definition of rhino is anti-Trump. And the definition of liberal, if you're a liberal, if you're not with Trump.
Yeah.
That's it. Pure and simple. Yeah. And it's so funny. You're like, okay. I mean, it is perverse. I'm curious, what did you make of Congressman Jacobs and what happened to him and the New York Republican, Western New York? I mean, this is
the Republican, just to give context,
yeah,
who came out after the shootings in Buffalo and said he was open to an just assault open. Weapons ban. Open to it.
And I say this because this is what I mean when I think, no wonder we're all so cynical about everybody that's involved in the political system, right? Whether it's the journalists that cover it, the people that are serving in it. Just debating an idea, which is the whole point of being there in Congress, is a fireable offense. And everybody ran for the hills from him. Now, shows you the power of the gun issue in Republican primaries. Right, which you and I have both known this. Anybody who spent time in a Republican, you know, the word Second Amendment means a hell of a lot more than just identifying a number in the Constitution, right? You are sending a cultural message. But that is another sort of chip away, if you will. You know, I don't know how else to put it. You know, that guy, he didn't commit any, look at his voting record. He's not this is not some rhino. He's acting like a human being. He's like wondering, I don't know, maybe we should think about these things, you know? But the idea that you can't even consider it, or therefore you're a traitor, I mean, that is thought police stuff. Like we are entering a new era of, whoa, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's such an interesting and potentially cautionary tale. I think there's good reason to be skeptical that the kind of assault weapon ban that we've seen before, the kind of assault weapon ban that we would likely see come out of this, would be very effective. But the whole point would be to have the debate, right? Let's have.
We're not
that
even allowed
discussion.
To have the debate, right?
Right.
You're like, wait. Why can't
that.
We have the debate?
Totally.
That's all we want.
Right. Right. I think that's what's so interesting. And look, I mean, this is the way. It's usually not on policy issues, but the way the Republican Party has acted over the past 7-8 years is that you are not allowed to be outside of what's acceptable. And usually that means supporting Donald Trump or, you know, being aligned with the issues that Donald Trump thinks are important. You have to be where Trump is on those issues or you're out. This is interesting because it's a policy issue. And, you know, effectively he said afterwards, he decided he wasn't going to run. He said, I think I still could have won, but boy, this sends a message. I'm not sure he could have won.
Well, I'm sorry he didn't try.
Yeah.
Because I do think you want to have, I almost want to force voters to have this debate. Do you want, you know, the whole point of the People's House, do you want them responsive to events on the ground? you know, that it's part of the political experiment, and I'm sorry it's not taking place, right?
Right,
you know,
exactly.
Show me how, you know, make your best argument as to, you know, what bothers me, for instance, on this, it's like, all right, well, is there a way to create some, you know, okay, you don't need a license for this type of firearm, but maybe you do for this type of firearm. And maybe you do need a waiting period if you want to buy this type. You know, what was wrong with having a nuanced conversation about this? You know, everything is like all in one. Well, let's all, everything's an assault weapon and raise the age. Well, no, I understand that not everything's an assault weapon. What's wrong with creating different categories of guns? Like, we have a commercial driver's license, you know, I mean, you know, we have to do other things. And I know there's nothing in the Constitution that enshrines the right to drive cars. I could feel the Twitter attack on the right already. But, you know, the fact that you can't even have a policy discussion. Look, you know, I miss the old days when you're like, hey, we should have a, we should figure out how to fund childcare. All right, do you do it with tax credits, or you do it with this, or you do it with that? You know, you have a liberal and conservative conversation about it. Do you spend money on it? Do you raise money with taxes? Do you do it as tax credit? You know, whatever it is. But we're not even, we're not allowed to have that.
We don't have the conversation. I mean, this is, it's, this is what's, I think, changed now. Now we're going to sound like the,
I know,
the old guys on the Muppet Show, right? Like, you know, yelling and wagging our,
back in
our
my
fingers.
Day, we barely got things done. Oh, sorry.
The,
you know, that's the,
yeah,
thing.
I mean,
what are we arguing for? The good old days was only less dysfunctional.
Right. But there was, I mean, there were debates about these issues. And, you know, even as recently as, you know, as 2010, as 2012, as 2014, you had, the discussions had some policy focus in a way that they don't. And I think what makes this interesting is this really is sort of a policy purge of Chris Jacobs. It's I don't think it necessarily signals a return to that, because we have sort of campaigning and governance by assertion, by outrage now. I mean, it's all performative politics. We talk a lot about performative politics.
Well, this is, you know, we talk, remember the fear of, God, campaigns are now all the time, the 24-hour campaign, it's all the time. Unfortunately, governance and campaigning are the same now, right? It used to be you had, oh, we had a year to govern and a year to campaign, right? Well, actually, it used to be 6 months of campaigning,
right,
half
exactly.
of governing, you know. But anyway, we kept chipping away. Now there's no distinction. You have to begin your reelection campaign on January 3rd when you're sworn in.
Yeah, yeah. Did we, so this is, I didn't expect to ask you this, but since I'm in the business of putting you on the spot, you and I first got to know each other working at a place called The Hotline, running National Journal. Obsessive campaign coverage, like constant, nonstop. This is all we did. We knew about the third place finisher in the North Dakota AG race. I mean, this, and I loved it. Did we contribute to this problem?
So I have this. I have this. When I'm in my more pondering moments, and I'll just leave. We'll decide what chemicals are helpful to that or not. I think about this a lot. Now I defend what we do in that we didn't try to, we weren't writing for the masses. We were writing for the professionals, and we were a trade publication. We were not pretending that this is what all political coverage should look like. Now, what I always say is Mark Halperin and The Note decided to take what we did and infuse it in the national coverage. And then arguably John Harris and Jim VandeHei took Politico and said, hey, we're going to take this because it's inherently more interesting, right? I mean, look, why did you and I have early success in our lives? Because people loved reading our shit, okay? Because they were like, wow, this is great. It's like reading a horse racing form, or it's like reading, you know, what's going, you know, whatever it is. It's like it was
like who's sports. Up and down. It was
who's
it was
up,
all
who's
of
down.
That.
But that was our job. People paid us a lot of money. Every subscription with thousands of dollars. So this was a, you know, I always joked it was OPM. It was other people's money, right? Everybody paid us from some company account, whatever. But we were not, the average voter was not supposed to be reading our stuff. And it wasn't, we were hiding it from them. It was just like, look, we were writing insidery. But I've thought about this a lot, brother, that there's no doubt that you know, when you look at now 538, and I say this with admiration, not, I'm not, you know, attacking, but I mean, 538 should be behind a paywall. Okay. You know, it, of course, you know, it's going to, well, why shouldn't this be open to everybody? Well, it is for a price. But it shouldn't be. It shouldn't be a substitute for political journalism. And the thing is that, you know, look, I don't know how we could have built a better beast here. And, you know, it's also one of those where I make myself feel better. Well, if it wasn't us, it'd have been somebody else. But somehow we work for somehow we invented something that other people have made a lot of money off of, but you and I never did. and poor Doug Bailey. I always said Doug Bailey, the late Doug Bailey, he had better ideas than most of Silicon Valley. He just didn't have the funders.
Right. You didn't have anybody to back them. I think about it a lot too. I mean, to the extent that we talked about policy back then, it was as policy and governance informed campaigning. But
yeah, like we knew a lot about ethanol.
Announced that about, like,
we knew a lot about ethanol,
right?
Because exactly. of Iowa, right? Exactly. Like, you know, we knew a lot about heating oil in New England because of New Hampshire, you know. But it was we were always about the policy as it impacted the campaign.
Right. And I think what's happened, and it certainly accelerated during the Trump era, is it becomes so much easier for people who haven't been here for very long. A lot of young journalists who come to Washington. It's easy to understand the who's up and who's down. It's a lot harder to understand the history of nuclear deterrence and Congress's role in funding, you know, nuclear improvement. It that takes real knowledge and experience.
So let me go to something where I think it's, you know, in the basic journalism questions of who, what, where, when, et cetera. I always say the most important question I read people for now is the why. You know, I read the Dispatch, not for the who and the what. No offense, we all have the who and the what. It's the why, right? That's the differentiator of any publication. And the best publications, the best news programs or publications or whatever you want to call them these days, newsletters, et cetera, are those that focus on the why with context and nuance and explain. And look, there is always been an intersection between policy and campaigns and politics and all of that, but explain it. Explain the why a little bit more. And I do think voters need to know that information. Hey, so-and-so is supportive of that because of this. Okay, I get it. You know, I think that stuff does matter, but it is, I wish more journalists focused on the why. They really want to focus on the who or the what, because that's the first click, right? You know, and I get that.
We don't need to. I know you got to run, and I appreciate the time you've given us. But if you look at the main function of journalists, if you and I were covering the 1976 presidential campaign, we're out at a stump speech from Gerald Ford. Our sole function is to tell people what happened. Right? They have no opportunity to know that other
now,
than
maybe,
through
and
us.
By the way, we might also. You know, I've always said with television, you're trying to bring. I would say, what distinguishes television from print? We're supposed to bring you to the event.
Yeah, there's an immediacy.
So hopefully I'm bringing you, and who are the people that came? And hey, we'll talk to some of the people that went. You know, that's sort of that would be the distinction between the two. But, you know, David Broder back then might have gone out to talk to people that were at the speech, and he would tell you, here was some of the reaction, right?
Sure, for sure. You can get into the secondary questions, but I think the distinction is they were secondary questions. The main thing that journalists did for years, for decades, was tell us what happened. And then you got into these other things. And now, because you can watch a speech live on Twitter, you can see it streamed sort of anywhere on your phone. Nobody needs to tell you the what anymore. And so journalists just skip that what happened, and they get to the why. And I think it's certainly distorted the way we take information.
You're right. The day-to-day journalist gets to the why. Like, I mean, you know, this is one of those where you should earn your way to being the why reporter.
Correct. Yes. That's and you earn it because
you and I
and
worked,
then you know.
You and
you
I
have
worked
some
two
authority.
Decades to get to become why reporters.
Yes.
I'll be honest.
You
like,
have
you're
some
right.
authority. You have some authority. And that's a big difference. It's one of the reasons that things aren't as good as they used to be. Thus ends our grumpy section. What is the name of those Muppet guys? Because that is exactly what we sound like. It's really
God.
Bad. I can't remember.
Yeah, you're right. And we're supposed to know they're Waldorf.
One of them was Waldorf,
which I do think is supposed to be some sort of like Waldorf Astoria shot. You know what I
is
mean?
Is that
like,
right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Of course, rich people in balconies wearing tuxedos are named Waldorf.
I did love those guys. They were, you know, they were
well,
great.
That's, I remember my old man, we had this deal. We watched the Muppets came on. The Muppets came on right before the Louis Rukeyser report. So we had one TV. So my dad, I think the Muppets were at 7:30 and on Fridays, and I got to watch. He would let me watch the Muppets, but I had to sit there and watch Louis Rukeyser with him for a half an hour.
Did you stay awake? That's pretty good.
Probably. I don't know, a little bit, but not really. Not really. But the fact that I know who Louis Rukeyser is probably tells you everything you need to know.
And I do too.
The household I was raised in.
Totally. Yeah. Exactly.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
All right. Exit question. As most people know, who listen to this podcast, you're a longtime Green Bay Packers fan.
Yeah, Packer Mafia.
Packer owner. Are you an owner? Do you have the ownership?
Yeah, four shares.
I'm an owner. So as co-owners of the Packers.
Multi-generational. My kids are too.
Excellent. Very good. I could do that for upcoming birthdays and holidays. Football season's a long way off. We're finally in mandatory OTAs right now. Packers, the rap on the Packers is that they don't have any wide receivers. They have the MVP quarterback returning. They don't have any wide receivers, but the defense looks beefed up. They lost last year, heartbreaking fashion yet again, didn't make it to the Super Bowl. Do the Packers make the Super Bowl in 2022? Or I guess it'll be 2020.
By the way, did you watch the golf thing?
I did
with Aaron Rodgers,
and I did not.
I stumbled on it. It's so funny. It was Mahomes, Allen, Brady, and Rodgers. And I guess what I would say is they all played to type.
Is that right?
Meaning
not necessarily great for Rodgers.
Who do you think took it the most seriously?
Yeah.
Who do you think weirdly took it the most seriously? Rodgers.
Right.
And by the way, he was the only one that looked more like a golfer. The other three actually looked like you and I out there in the course trying to hack away, which was kind of, it was fun to see Patrick Mahomes look like any other numbskull trying to hit a drive.
Right.
You know, hitting it too hard. He also threw down a 16 ounce, you know,
really?
A few times. Yeah. Mahomes and Allen were exactly what we all wish we were in our 20s. They were having a great time. And do it. But Rodgers took it all seriously. And you just wonder because of Brady's there, you know, and Rodgers hit the winning putt. And, you know, and he has the Brady chip, you know, a little bit.
Yes.
The Pollyannish view in me is this. If you look at the last two Super Bowl champion, I would argue they won not because of their offense, but because of their defense, Tampa and the Rams. And the one thing we've done that I think's that is we've now matched their defense, right? I think we have, you know, I think our defense is younger than the Rams, right?
Yeah.
The Rams have an older defense.
Yeah.
Tampa Bay has, you know, and it's an easier path, right? So, and I never worry about, you know, did anybody think Donald Driver was going to be a great receiver? Did anybody think Antonio Freeman was going to be a great receiver? Did anybody think Jordy Nelson was going to be a great receiver? I mean, If the Packers have a track record at finding something out of nothing at any position on the field, I'd argue it's wide receiver. So, you know, and if Aaron Rodgers is the most accurate passer, he makes, you know, as long as you don't drop balls, he'll make you a successful receiver. Look, we're going to find out how good Devontae is in Vegas, right? We, you know, but I would note, what did Greg Jennings do in Minnesota? What did James Lofton did. Sorry, I want to keep going back to the Raiders. Like, I know. All right, maybe I'm doing.
Well, Jordy Nelson played for the Raiders, right?
He played for the Raiders.
Yeah.
I think we've had a couple of guys end their career with the Raiders for some reason.
James Jones.
Yeah.
Right.
James Jones did too. Yeah. 89. Yeah. So I'm less concerned about that. You know, we've arguably been essentially a play or two away from the Super Bowl the last 2 years. So it's kind of frustrating. It's like watching, if you're into the NBA, it's sort of like, and you're a Miami Heat fan, and I'm kind of a Miami Heat just by default, because I'll care about my hometown team. And you're like, well, you know, geez, they were a play away here, play away there, and they might have won the title. How much do you shake up your team? Right? Like, and I think that's a, like, I want to criticize the Packers for not getting this done. And it will be terrible if they don't get another Super Bowl with Aaron Rodgers, right? It will be, he will be Dan Marino. And that's a bummer, because he's better than that. No offense, Marino.
Yeah.
Don't you like everybody writing us off? Everybody, all the elite NFL people are like, oh, the Packers are done.
It helps. I think that helps. I mean, Aaron Rodgers clearly does well when he has a chip on his shoulder.
All we'll do is go 13-3 again.
This will add it. And I think, look, don't sleep on Alan Lazard. This is the most self-indulgent portion of the Dispatch podcast we've ever done.
Just so you know, for you Dispatch fans here, the only person that thinks Alan Lazard's a Pro Bowl receiver on earth, other than any member of the Lazard family, is Mr. Hayes.
I have an Alan Lazard jersey that I bought at Lambeau, and they didn't have it on the racks. I had to take a blank
special order
and have them go make it for me. And the best part was Alan Lazard's friend from Iowa State was in front of me in line. And he looked at me like, you're buying an Alan Lazard jersey? And it was like his college roommate.
Awesome.
Yeah, it was pretty
crazy. Like the guy, you know, well, you know, go, you should buy his rookie base football card too. You know, if you're going to go in, right? Buy all his stock.
Well, thank you. Thank you for this. I do think this, the last 5 minutes has been easily the most self-indulgent recorded Dispatch podcast.
Isn't that why podcasts were invented? What every person who does a podcast loves about podcasts, and what everybody who listens to podcasts hates about podcasts. The self-indulgent aspect.
We tried it, particularly in this pod, when we do the interview podcast, we try to have a heavy explainer vibe to it, and provide real content. And I think we accomplished that at the beginning, so we're justified.
You know what's kind of fun now? You have that person who's probably may have dozed off a little bit. No offense, I get it. We all doze off, right? They're listening to us, and then they wake back up and go, am I listening to another podcast?
Is this a different
podcast?
Why is this
Packers talk?
Well, thanks for doing this. Eager to see what happens with the January 6th committee this week. And appreciate your time.
All right, brother.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.